and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. I'm Fiona.
And I'm Sarah, and we are very excited today to episode 5 of our conception to production summer season. Have you listened to the other ones? Have you?
Mm.
This is our weekly podcast on talking to and interviewing some of the amazing creators of wonderful audio drama podcasts on how they started and conceived their ideas through to casting and production.
And this week you've been talking to Lance Dan from Blood Cultural.
He is, and it's nice to talk to some British folks.
Of course. So,
we had a very good chat. And once you've had a look at and around all of their amazing sites, it's not just Blood Cultural you can look at. There's all sorts of offshoots that they've created, which we talk about in this podcast. Please head on over to thepodcasthost.com for some more exciting adventures in podcasting.
Absolutely. And if you want to email us about this episode or indeed any of these conception to production seasons, do at... Do you want to give it?
No, I
have another go. Go on, you can do it.
Okay, audio. No, I can't even read now.
At podcast@audiodramaproduction.com.
Oh, one day I'll get it, Fiona.
You will.
Here's Lance with some absolute erudite information. Hello, we have the wonderful Lance Dan from the Blood Cultural Podcast and more with us today. Hello there, Lance.
Hello indeed there, Sarah.
It's very exciting to speak to you.
Back again, even though the audience don't think I've been away, but...
we have to say, we did actually have a wonderful interview together in the middle of St. James's Park, but sadly, the sound editing fairies...
We were sat together in the sunshine in a park.
It was beautiful.
It was beautiful with the sirens and the helicopters and many, many tourists.
It was... I think maybe we might insert a little bit here and then the people can hear, you know, what they might have had for an hour or so instead of these beautiful, clear, dulcet tones.
Location recording is time-consuming and you have to deal with, ironically, external noise. There's a helicopter above us.
Yes,
and people walking their dogs.
So yes, I'm very excited to speak to you again, and you have got such a wonderful CV of fun, eventful things. I don't know if you can give a short summary of the exciting adventures in podcasting that you've had in the last however many years for us.
I've been working in radio for 30 years now, but particularly at the BBC and in independent radio and working in America, and I had some real near scrapes to the very, very pre-RSS, pre-podcast days of audio drama when I was in New York.
Yes.
Just tantalizingly close to being involved in some extraordinary sort of early projects. But then over the last decade, I suppose, I produced a work called Flicker Man, which was a very early audio drama for podcast form when people were frowning at me for doing it in about 2008. And, you know, I've been around podcasting and radio. I kind of work with the BBC and work in feature making and writing and drama. And at the moment, Blood Culture went out and was broadcast in, I think, finished in this summer.
Yes.
And we're currently looking at another season or a follow-up. Let's call it a follow-up.
Exciting. I must say, you are writing, you're an academic as well, from what I gather, doing very clever things.
Yeah, I work as an academic I'm writing a book about podcasting. Ironically, there you go. It's like a critical analysis of podcasting published by Bloomsbury, which means I'm expecting the same level of publicity as they gave to Harry Potter. I mean, it's the same publishing house. There's no reason why people won't be queuing outside Waterstones dressed as me at 5 a.m. to get the book on podcast.
I would actually love that. I think that needs to happen.
I think I'll be dressed as me drinking at Waterstones to get a copy. But no, it's great. We've interviewed about 40 or so people across the podcast space. And there's a great little chapter written by me, so it has to be great, about audio drama, where I'm kind of breaking down where audio drama is right now. And I've interviewed pretty much all the big figures across audio drama. I kind of went through the iTunes top 30 the other day and just had great fun going, got you. A few I hadn't got.
It's like Panini sticker books of the 1980s.
Exactly. But yeah, got a few doubles. Well, I'll swap you black tapes for homecoming. Never got homecoming.
The silver paper ones.
But yeah, we've kind of talked from everyone from the scene, and it's really kind of useful because I mean, as an academic, most academics sit back and just kind of pontificate and are not clued in and not sort of switched on about what's really happening in many ways. They're very removed, whereas actually really talking to the people who are making this stuff kind of makes me really realise why it is the shape it is and why it works the way it is. And also, you know, making work myself. I mean, I've certainly learnt. I'm still learning. I mean, you know, I'm figuring stuff out as I go along, and I'm still making delicious mistakes all the time.
And just with regards to the whole blood cultural sensation, so can you talk us through, because this is obviously the part of our conception to production season, so how long was it before you even kind of got to casting that you were working on this as a project?
Well, blood culture blood culture was a fully funded audio drama. So that means that we had quite a decent sized budget, a BBC level budget to produce it. And that obviously gives you a great deal of freedom to cast who you like, to produce stuff how you like, to get great people involved. And that was the really exciting thing about it. But there's a downside to that. And the downside to going for full funding ahead is that the time implication. It was about a 2-year project to start from a bid going into the Wellcome Trust, who are a great big they're big pharma. they do medical and biomedical research, and they want to do public outreach work about their field, and they've got very deep pockets, incredibly deep pockets. So they, a bid went into them, and I think I've got documents that early drafts that say 2014 on, and I think the bid went in spring 2015. So you're talking a 2-year turnaround. And then, also with bid processes, you put in the bid, and actually we were accepted very fast, but it still took 4 months. So again, you can put your bid in and then you can sit back and you have to wait for it to kind of spit out the other end. But that's all the kind of pre-production before you've even started writing. You're issuing a bid. And one thing about writing bids is that very often you'll come up with an idea that sounds great when you write it down into that condensed form you need for a bid, and then sure enough, when you actually come to make it, everything slightly changes and you kind of develop it and you have to push it on further, and the idea kind of can change quite a lot. So it's not like you sort of take this sort of idea that gets green lit and then immediately write it up. A whole bunch of sort of tertiary development occurs after the bid is accepted.
And what kind of core team were responsible for moving that along, other than yourself?
I had a guy who worked with me in the early development phase called Phil, and he was kind of like around during the writing. So it was most, and then there's an executive producer, a guy called Nick Ware, who's got a lot of experience and is once head of BBC for the TV channel, and also had worked for a fair bit with Wellcome Trust on board. So there's a small core team. I went in with Resonance, who are an experimental art station in London, and they kind of backed the project and gave me, they helped sign the checks and organize it, and you don't just get a big fat check off the Wellcome Trust that's dumped into your account. It had to go through a company.
Okay.
So that's the kind of, you know, one has this infrastructure and you go in with those companies, but it's very much like a single, you know, I'm like the mad captain at the head of the ship, kind of guiding and shaping the project. And that kind of goes through the, like I said, the bid goes in, you sit around, you have to answer a few questions, and then the project's activated. And then a period of, you know, furious research starts where we kind of went around, and because it had to be tied in with biomedical, everything had to be based on fact.
Yes.
We had to go and talk to lots of scientists and biomedical consultants. And there was another kind of 4 months of just going around and talking to people and making sure that all these things, all these ideas about stem cells and cutting edge science and blood doping was all anchored in science. So that was kind of like another phase. And all that time, we also kind of got a mini writer's room of three of us breaking down episodes.
Great.
You know, working out story structure. Lots of whiteboards full of arrows.
Luxury.
So and that kind of, you know, and out of that you get your five episodes. And then you go into writing.
Yeah, and with the actual whole podcast, what I absolutely loved about it is it didn't kind of educate you in a kind of sit down and listen kind of way. It was beautifully woven into the plot of the podcast, and not only that, but there were kind of tendrils of, I think, was it transmedia, you've called it in the past, where people were able to access beyond the audio drama. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Well, as far as how, you know, working in content, I'm working in kind of factual content. In actual fact, I think that we did some research into how the audience responded. We actually talked to the audience. Mm. And we did interviews with kind of key audience members.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say actually that they didn't actually take that much from those moments of explication where someone would have, you know, we tried to write a whodunit where you, to understand what was going on, you had to understand the science.
Okay.
So to figure out what the evil company Meta were up to, you had to get your head around some scientific concepts, which, and therefore they had to be explained. Mm-hmm. And we tried to find, you know, attractive ways to do it. But actually, for a lot of the time, the audience were like, well, you know, we were just into the story. And it really reminded me of that moment. If you watch Doctor Who, there's always a point in Doctor Who, well, whoever the Doctor Who, where he talks very, very fast and he explains something with what sounds like gibberish. But if you actually slow it down, it actually kind of makes some kind of scientific sense.
Surreptitious learning.
Well, I don't think you're meant to learn there. David, who was part of the writing team, had worked on Doctor Who. And I said to him, I watched Doctor Who with my six-year-olds. They don't, you know, how are they meant to get that? And he goes, look, Lance, they're not meant to.
Okay.
You know, don't worry. It's only for the fans who bother to listen. The kids, it's like, oh, Doctor Who's talking fast. And I realised actually a lot of the people listening to Blood Culture were kind of like the science, they'd be like, yeah, it's all right. You know, they're just like, oh, they're talking the science bit. But it was all the stuff around it that helps make that, remind people and impact that kind of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't necessarily what people said in the show. It was like the after show chats.
Yes.
And then we had websites and we had peculiar Twitter feeds and games and all these little bits around the edge that extended the universe. And through that, not only did people get a deeper experience where we were rewarded and the fans got sucked in more and more, but also they kind of, you know, they added little bits to their knowledge. And to the extent that eventually people were like, oh, actually, I do know about sickle cell anemia. I didn't know that, you know. There's a great story about one person going down the pub to a pub quiz and a question coming up about sickle cell thalassemia, which is what one of the characters has got. And this person knew all the answers, and his mates were like, well, hang on, how come you know about that? He said, oh, this is a podcast I listen to.
Yeah,
so people were kind of taking that information in.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the transmedia element, this idea of extending the narrative beyond the podcast, is kind of like, that's what the Flicker Man had, my earlier work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like just that sense of not wanting a story to end at the end of the show.
Yeah. Oh, that's the point, yeah. Now, there are some podcasts you think, oh, please, I don't want it to be the last episode, and you kind of, you brace yourself and you're ready for it. But when it does, you do feel quite bereft. So, yes. So what ways could people link with it, this particular podcast?
So the big game we played, I mean, the most fun thing we did was that it was about a an Apple-like, cult-like tech company and their mm-hmm. various wrongdoings. And we had a sort of company website set up where people could apply to work for the company. And then if you actually applied, then you put in your, they asked for your phone number to contact mm-hmm. you back for your application. And you put in your phone number and then your phone would go off and you get a text from the company. And then people could have a conversation with someone at the company who was like, you know, one of the interns there who was rather dissatisfied and would then eventually start to admit what was going on. And an adventure would start and you chat to this person. And this was all a chatbot we set up, this uh-huh. sort of crazy program that would occasionally fall down. This girl called Justine. So sometimes, you know, you'd have a perfectly good conversation with her and it was all based on algorithms of what people might say to her. And it mm-hmm. was something that just some friends and I built. And it was great fun because, you know, we could see how people were responding and they really would talk to her via text like she was a real person.
Well, I have to say that I did actually take part in that and it got quite exciting at certain points. And it did become like, I knew it wasn't real, but it was fun just investing that time in a little bit of extra story, I guess.
I love reading about what people said, where people were like, you know, asking her out for a drink and things like that. And then the fun thing would be then to see someone had done that and then predict it for future. So if someone said, oh, do you want to come out for a drink to this program, then I wouldn't have like programmed a response in, so she'd just go into a loop or go wrong. But okay, actually, the great thing was then to go, oh, people are going to ask her out for a drink, and if I say, oh no, I don't want a drink, you know, I'm busy at the moment, then it would make it seem even more real. And then after the final stages of the game, people would actually call me up or call up one of the characters and actually end up getting me, or have live text conversations with me. So occasionally I'd be out and I'd start getting texts from players, from fans, and I'd start responding back. And then people would really start freaking out because then there was a real person chatting to them. But because of the nature of fandom, because of the nature of people, the way people interact, only a very small people actually kind of delve deep enough to get to the end.
Yeah.
And that's just the way these things work. You have a core of people who dig deeper and deeper.
That's interesting. Why do you think that might be? Is that because that they are not used to that kind of style of thing? Do you think that maybe they didn't know that that was there? Or
it's absolutely inherent in people's relationship to the media. 99% of people can't be bothered to press a red button, can't be bothered to access anything more. They just want to have an experience. That's their experience. Boom, it's over. And then 0.9% of people do a bit more and 0.1% of people will dig and dig and dig. And it's true everywhere. Obviously, if you have a huge audience, if 0.1% are behaving obsessively, you can have enough for a fan convention. with Blood Culture, it's not a massive audience, you know, not in
with those big
millions.
Beanbags from Meta, that'd be lovely, aren't they?
I mean, this is it. And funny, you know, that was kind of, you know, funny conversations on Twitter and one of the team were manning the Twitter account from Meta, the company, and getting into weird discourse with people. But yeah, it's very much like that's you can't avoid that with fandom. When I first did the Flickr Man, I was always a bit disappointed that not that many people drilled down. I went to a meeting with the BBC and I was talking to them about a Radio Free project. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, we had this interactive thing where the audience on Radio Free were asked to send in pictures of the idealized imaginary fantastical village, and we built this image of this village. And I said, oh, how many people did this? And the producer said, oh, not many. And his researcher said, oh, about six, wasn't it? And I thought, ah, there you go. And the producer looked kind of awkward, and I was thinking, yeah, it happens to you too. You know, no matter if you're BBC, not very many people drill down.
Because I was actually quite gutted that Meta didn't actually exist, because I was looking for a job at the beginning of the summer and I thought, oh, this looks quite fun.
They would have bled you dry. Actually, one of the funny things that's come out afterwards is plot lines that you kick out because they're too obvious and then you see other people doing. There's a lot of stuff around. If people Google around young people's blood being sold because it's meant to give older people improved cognitive functioning, comes from some research they did with mice, where they gave old mice, younger mice, mouse blood, and the mice kind of there started forming, you know, synaptic nerves started reforming and they were improved. So now there are companies selling young people's blood to older people and that was that is so creepy and so vampiric. And I looked at it and went, nah, it's too obvious. And now it's sort of out there and I'm like, oh, It would be a great plot line.
Wow. I might get my name on one of those lists. I don't know if I'm a young or an old person, though.
But I just, yeah, you can. Sometimes you make a mistake as a writer. You just think, oh, no, it's too obvious. And sometimes it's not. You know, sometimes the obvious stuff is staring you in the face.
But then you can maybe work that into something else. So as far as reach is concerned, what I'm fascinated by as well is you say you had the relationship with Resonance FM, and I'm just really interested to fathom whether, you know, being attached to that radio station and getting that kind of demographic gave you a wider range than, or a different range of people perhaps from where you put it on iTunes and your other hosting sites. Can you talk us a little bit about that?
There's two kind of factors there. First of all, the audience on a podcast for audio drama is much younger, and you know, it's millennial, it's obviously international, and especially with something like, you know, the kind of blog culture and a lot of the, you know, a lot of the big podcasts out there, they've kind of got this sort of culty, you know, it comes out of the, I mentioned Doctor Who for a reason, you know, it comes out of sort of things like Doctor Who and sci-fi culture, and you can see that in the themes and topics of the podcast. There's a lot of genre works, so you're kind of accessing, if you're making podcasts, you're hitting that kind of audience. The audience to a station like Resonance is willfully diverse, what it tries to be, but it's probably older, and it's probably it's quite educated, and people who are into arts and quite diverse interests, so they're very accepting as an audience. You might not get the same passion from a Resonance audience for your project, or for a radio audience, but you'll get a bigger audience and you'll get a broader audience, and you know, you'll hit surprising people. So I mean, one of the nice things about radio is that, you know, I work for the BBC, and of course, you know, you're getting much bigger audiences. And you're getting people, you are getting a broader cross-section of society. But the nice thing about podcasts is that people form such a strong relationship with them.
Yes.
You know, that there is a real intimacy and a real kind of passion that people feel for shows that they follow and they get involved with. And just on the level of, you know, interaction and the number of people kind of following blog culture, the guy who helped us doing the interviews with the kind of fans and followers, say, God, that you've got the same sort of involvement in numbers as you'd get from, say, if I did this research for Coronation Street, a massive UK soap.
Superb.
And it's not our numbers are anywhere near Coronation Street. It's that the podcast fans are more passionate. So when I talked about that fall off in audience involvement, it's actually less extreme than it for a podcast than it would be, say, for a soap opera, where there's a huge, huge, huge disinterested audience, or mildly interested, or, you know, people who just follow and just watch and don't want to go any further. So that's what you're kind of getting. So what Resonance gives you is access to larger audiences and more broad audiences. And it kind of gives you a legitimacy, which is a shame. And it's something I've picked up from the interviews I've done with podcasters, is that actually having a radio show, being on traditional radio, is kind of like, oh, you've got some, you know, you've got some marker there. Uh-huh. Someone's picked you to go on air. Mm-hmm. That's quite a traditional view, but it does seem to be prevalent.
Bit more kudos, yeah.
Yeah, actually. And it doesn't, I don't think it's kind of right. I mean, if you, I prefer the kind of more Wild West of the podcast sphere. And I kind of, you know, I prefer the way that shows can bubble up out of nowhere, which is why the networks are a bit of a shame, because they're kind of, you know, they're blocking up space and they're not allowing.
They're becoming more prevalent, aren't they? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's making the indies, real indies, harder to burst out and to come through as kind of surprises.
Interesting.
Some level, like a good network could act as a union, and like a bunch of people getting together.
Yep.
And supporting each other. So I'm quite impressed with Radiotopia.
Yes. Wondery Network and all that, yes.
But, you know, other podcast networks seem to be, you know, where they're trying to push a financial model, are very protectionist, and, you know, they're not necessarily letting this space breathe.
Okay, interesting. So keep going, independent podcasts. Make sure you don't get squeezed out by the big boys.
People kind of still, you know, they go, oh, I don't think there'd be another Night Vale. you know, where you wouldn't get something blowing up like that. But when I interviewed the Black Tapes boys, gosh, they came out of nowhere with that project. I kept on asking them, what was your strategy and what was your marketing plan and how did this happen? And they were like, we just did it.
Right.
We just did it and put it out and people latched onto it. And I'm just like, that's unbelievable. You know,
amazing.
I interviewed Casey Whalen with We're Alive, and that was, as you know, that was as long ago as the Flicker Man. That was like 8 years ago. So that was an earlier stage.
Still amazing. But, you know, popular,
but Black Tates blew up 2 years ago and it came out of nowhere.
Mm. Yeah, there's a new series out just now, actually, isn't there? Yeah, no, it fascinates me. It really does. And with regards to kind of the Blood Cultural's place in the kind of podcasting world, how did you launch this show? So you've got the funding, you've then written it with your core team, you've already just talked briefly about. What were your next steps to getting it out?
Okay, well then, I mean, absolutely, the team I assembled around it, I mean, there was about 30 people involved or so.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you got a big production team and I guiltily admit to the fact that I actually just activated a lot of old contacts in a rather poorly planned hurry. And I think one thing to learn from that actually is, and as you know, this thing about making mistakes is also just looking forward and just like pre-planning a bit more in terms of who I bring in and recognizing now that, okay, I'm going to need someone here and someone there and someone in on marketing and someone in on press.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of planning those things ahead. So in the next project, there'll be less laying the track in front of the train.
Yeah.
and really, you know, thinking about issues like press, I found press very hard to get.
Mm.
My previous projects hadn't. And I was like, oh, God, you know, it's just luck. But you can make your own luck. You can. And I don't think I was quite canny enough on this one to get mainstream press.
Okay.
Whereas previously, I think I'd just got lucky. I got mainstream press and it makes a difference.
And regards to casting process, so you've got your script. Where did you go from there? How did you go about recruiting your core superb cast?
Well, I mean, the thing is, once you've got budget, the conversation changes. Yes. I can pay the actors. They kind of, I worked with a very experienced casting director and he also worked as a assistant director.
Okay.
These roles get a bit muddy, but Al Gilchrist had kind of been around acting forever and was able to contact brilliant agents.
Mm-hmm.
So he went through a sequence of agents and then we sent out, I've created a very carefully written casting call sheet where I talked about the roles and I talked about the project. Now, I actually kind of went back to, you know, how did I know how to write a casting call sheet? I basically looked around online and found some good examples because I'd sort of lost track of how to do that really well. And knowing the project so well and having a passion for the project, I was able to write a good call sheet. So the combination between a good agent, a good casting director, and a decent call sheet meant that the people who were offered up to us were, you know, were good, you know, were in the right ballpark. And then as far as the casting sessions, it's what I'd recommend is also if you're the writer producer is let things go. Let the voices in your head who've been chatting to you for the last 6 months or year, let them go, because someone different is going to walk into that room and read that script in a new way. And you can't go, oh, no, you're not Northern. Oh, you don't have that Croydon twang in your voice. I've imagined you being like, you know.
So well, region.
Exactly. Oh, no, but I mean.
Hi.
But there you let the actresses and the actors bring to the table what you want, what they want. And then you think about, can I work with that person? So a lot of it goes down to like, you got to relax into it, give them bits of script, give them a little kind of workshoppy thing to do on the fly that was fun to see how they could improvise. A sense of whether I could want to be in a room with that person for 2 weeks.
Did they smell? Yeah.
You know, how reliable are they? And they'll do the acting thing on you. They'll tell you the script is brilliant and they really like it. And you kind of go, oh, they're doing the actor thing on me. Oh, I like it. I think they're lying, but, you know.
Actors don't do that. Surely not.
They all go, oh, it's a great script. It's a great script. And I'm like, you're acting. You're just acting at me. But I still like hearing that.
All these poor actors who are truly honest to the core. People are thinking they're deceiving them all the way through.
But,
so that's such a luxury to have that face-to-face time then. I mean, how long did that process take then of casting? Over a couple of days or
couple of days? And then, but a lot of it, you know, some of the key roles were also dropped in for recommendations. Like, oh, you want someone for the Steve Jobs, the psychopath job, you've got to go for Jack Claff. And then Jack Claff's in Brighton and you meet him for a couple of cups of coffee and you're like, okay, you're perfect. You're hypnotic and charismatic.
Voice, yes.
And then Livy, who's our wildfire, tempestuous troublemaker. Again, someone said, oh, look, there's this brilliant actress I met a few years ago, you know, who's, she's so talented. I can't believe she's not famous. Drop her in, you know, and then something like that. So some of those people are dropped in, are invited in specifically. And are kind of parachuted into roles. So, yeah, there was a lot, you know, sat down with Al, a lot of kind of sat, also kind of filling out various roles around the edges. I mean, also with retrospect, and in this ties in with press, I should have saved a bit of money and got a name actor in, even if it's just for a day, just so that can also help legitimise it with the press. And I should have put £5,000 aside to bring in someone people have heard of for a day.
Yeah.
But again, you know, you when you're laying the track in front of the train, it's all like, oh God, I've only got a month to cast. And then you start talking to all the actresses.
Matthew McClain's not available. Robert Cudmore's busy.
Who yeah, they're all get? Busy months ahead. And you get these insane lines and you get all over excited. It's kind of like the weirdest one was like, oh my God, the dragon lady from Game of Thrones. She's like available and someone knows someone. And it's like, oh my God, we could possibly get her or whoever she's called.
Bend your knee, sir.
And of course, you know, it doesn't happen, but you start fantasizing about, oh, it's going to be huge. And again, with retrospect, going into it again, get those calls out early and you know that it's going to be a 9-month plan. And just good tips, you know, we used a lot of female actresses. And that was a really positive thing. Got some great people. But someone also said, look, if you're trying to get an A-list female actress who's 27, they're not going to spend, you know, time on your project because they're only at the top for such a short time. One of the horrible things about the industry is that for female actresses, you know, they're kind of like, they've got this time when they're super hot and they're not going to spend 2 weeks on some weird podcast. So you kind of got to factor in, okay, then get the right roles, get the right kind of people and kind of be a little bit pragmatic, you know, plan ahead on that. So I'm going to kind of, you know, look at that next time and try to.
Interesting, yeah. So maybe you should just aim for the 40 market of female actresses because I think there's a lot of lovely ones about. That aside, working with the actors in the room, so you actually were able to do mostly studio-based, is that right?
Yeah, I would have. We recorded it down in Brighton. And again, I would have liked to have done more location and more external work. And I think I'd schedule more of that, but it's got the right acoustic and it sounds right. And it's a pain in the ass because people walk their dogs and airplanes fly over and, you know, cars and things like that. And Brighton, the seagulls. Yeah. So once you kind of work around that, but actually the acoustic is just so raw and live. And if you've got people shouting at each other outside, you know, you can only do that outside.
Yes, the spatial awareness of that, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
But the rest of the time we were in studio, which kind of drove me mildly insane. And I learned that actually I was talking to John Dryden, who's a big BBC producer, and he was like, oh, I can do five-day weeks. And I'm like, I can do four-day weeks. I basically crack up. On day five, I was just like, useless.
Sunshine, yes.
So I did 2 weeks, and the last time I just went silly. But yeah, you bring in the actors in and out. You know, we tried to keep the cast down as much as possible, but there's still quite a lot of people. And then you've got a core team. You need a good recordist. You need a good assistant director to take the load. Had a brilliant script supervisor, a girl called Lizzie, who came out. You know, she was initially an intern and then ended up getting a role. But also as a director, you're very much, you know, you're like the head of some weird, screwed up 2-week family, and I think I'm very great believer in being inclusive, making sure everyone feels valued, and also being the last person to leave the room. You know, make sure that if people see you emptying the bins at the end of the day, or you know, doing a coffee
run. Weighing in them, yeah.
then they get that, you know, it's a shared experience, you know, and that yes. we're all in this together, especially when you throw these things together madly.
Yes.
And then you
get... It sounds fun, yeah.
And then you get more out of people by just being, look, this is the nature of the production. And, you know, my attitude to directing is let the actors and the actresses, let them lead it. You know,
yeah, because I was going to ask you what your top tips, if you're in this kind of, obviously you're time pressured, you know what you want to get out of people, but it's very much how that actor, you know, attacks your script and how you've helped them, you know what they need to do. So, yeah, top tips for directors in that group situation. What would you
give? If you cast right and you work with experienced people, then let them lead and you shape what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my approach. And let them, if they're not giving you what you want, just gently find ways to get different approaches out of them. You know, sort of think about whether they're giving energy, whether they're pulling it back. But also within the room, as a writer director, it's easier. Just you've got to know everyone's, I mean, it's an obvious thing, everyone's motivation. Everyone's got to have an end point. Uh-huh. Move a scene. Everyone's got to have a key word that they're getting out. And whoever they are in the room, even if they're in for one scene only, even if they're just crossing out through your drama for one scene, think about that character and make that person real. There's a writer's technique for prose writers, which is if you want to understand a character, you write a scene from their point of view, even if you don't use it. So you kind of would write it from putting that person as the centre. We're all protagonists in our own stories, so you have to treat all the characters in the room and the actors like they're the protagonist. And that comes from that equal way of respecting people. So if someone comes in and they're just in for an afternoon and they're doing one role, you should be able to sit down and talk through their character like their character is the most important person in the piece.
Sure.
Because we're all the most important people in our lives. Know the characters well, but also let the actors lead and let them breathe with it. And then start giving back and keeping the energy positive. Don't ever let them know your stress. If things go wrong, never kind of bark out at them. If ever there's a little bit of an edginess in the room, apologize then and there and move on. But yeah, I mean, I kind of bounce around like a, you know, keeping happy all the time.
You do strike me as a very kind of, let's get it done, yes, kind of man. So, yeah.
If you've got a tight schedule, you've experienced enough so you kind of know how long you have on each scene and slightly overestimate the time. You always want to be running under time each day. So you're actually wrapping early just in case something goes
psychologically
wrong.
Psychologically also, yes.
Oh, actually, with casting, just... always be careful about those people coming in for small roles, because if you've got a great cast together, someone who's not so great on a small role can trash it and suddenly it can bring the whole thing down. So just be careful of all those roles. If someone's not giving you what they want, get them lots. Don't try to keep the edge off them. Get them to read it in different ways. Think about different approaches.
Do you demonstrate yourself?
Never.
Things?
Never, unless I'm very familiar with someone. Unless I'm very kind of familiar and I'm kind of, it's someone who's basically a friend and I'm like, oh, can you say it like this? But I'd never do a line reading. And if that someone can't give you what they want, just get them to whisper the lines and then, which is my secret tip. If someone can't act, just whisper. I think we all sound okay whispering.
So I've got such a soft voice. I just whisper through everything.
If anyone's ever acting for me and I go, oh, why didn't you just whisper the lines? It means I've given up on you. And I can't get the performance I want and we have to move on. So
remember that, everyone.
Yes, yeah, watch out. Or whispered. But yeah, you get that in kind of intensity and I think just remember it's an equal space. You're not a dictator and it should be fun for everyone, even if you're doing a horror or something emotional or something with a lot of hits. Yeah. And those people give a lot, you know, actors give a lot to you. Yeah, and I think it's your responsibility to kind of respect that.
Mm. Now, I really love the diversity of your cast, I must say, as well, because, you know, it's quite refreshing to see so many female strong leads and you know, a diverse cultural cast as well, which is grand, because, you know, I think there is a penchant for specific demographics being represented more than others. So yes, I enjoyed that very much.
It's very much like writing strong women was like the women in my life. So it's kind of like, you know, that felt like those, I hadn't heard those voices. And I think that, you know, it was just tremendous fun writing those female characters who are still kind of based on women. I know they're still women, but they're not, you know, they're off on an adventure. And it's still kind of, you know, that's what matters is the thriller and the adventure, not, they're not sort of tied down by their gender. So that was kind of one of the issues I had in point. And also having two female leads is great because then as soon as you cut in another female character, it's like now you've got like scenes. There were points where I was looking in the studio and there's like, you've got four female, you know, four women acting opposite each other. And I'm like, you know, this is, you know, this is great. You know, how often do you get that?
Yes.
And they're not talking about, you know, things that you might get in some female-led dramas. You know, they're talking about thrillers and break-ins and spies.
Yes.
So it was tremendous fun.
The other thing I really very much enjoyed was, as like almost like another cast member, was your music, which had, you know, several different sort of changes throughout the whole piece. And I think that fascinated me. How did your music choices come about and were they as intrinsic as I think they were to the piece?
The music was, you know, there is really important. I think for an oral form, an aural form, the one thing that always surprises me in podcast drama and radio drama and audio drama in general is how much people backseat music, or they just pick up cinematic music. And it's the kind of thing that we'd see next to an action scene or a romantic scene in the cinema. And I just think that you can really colour your work by using distinct music. And you can take risks, because actually I was quite, you know, with this, I was like, oh God, some people might not like the music. But you know what? You've got to use your judgment. And in actual fact, people were kind of like, for the most part, saying, yeah, it had lots of atmosphere. And I think that comes from the music. And you let those, I work with the music of three composers. Claire Singer, who is a Scottish composer who did the theme and provided various string works and some drones. And we kind of, you know, reshaped and cut her work together. Filip Dukaszewski, who's a Polish composer who does quite moody electronic work. And I had just got the rights to use one of his albums that I really liked. So I was just cutting one of his albums. And then Simon James, who was one of the sound designers, who was working very intimately on the project. So we were able to really craft and shape his music to the scenes and hitting the rhythms of the scenes. And I think that's the thing, that when you're cutting music, don't be passive. Cut the music around the scene, cut the scene around the music. Let the two of them talk to each other actively. Splice and splice and splice, so that the rhythm and the ups and downs are really hitting each other, so they're really accenting or pulling back or syncopating. And use music doesn't necessarily fit sometimes. Surprise yourself, surprise the audience. You know, one of the tricks I do is I'll insist, kind of like I'll limit my palette, so that I'll have five pieces of music from Claire. I think there were about four from Philip, admittedly about 10 from Simon. So I had 20 pieces of music across the season, and I was recutting those in different shapes. But it makes you kind of go, oh, what should I use here? And instead of like getting someone to make something that fits the emotional dynamic absolutely perfectly, you get something that's close but surprising, and it gives it a different atmosphere. And then you start cutting the rhythms to the voice and so on, or vice versa. You can there are scenes in it where I've cut the voice to the beat or the rhythm of the music, and it very subtly works together. So if you listen to episode one, a character, there's a character dies, and about halfway through there's a very kind of somber piece of music by Filip Dukaszewski, and the voices are cut on the beats of people talking there to really accent that. And I think that you know, if it's, you've got to have confidence in what you're doing like that. And you know, I went to composers who I respected. And, you know, I suppose it's always been a kind of feature of my work too. There's a distinctive style, whether it's successful is another thing, but it kind of gives it an original feel.
Yeah, definite branding to it. Yeah, for sure. I thought it was, yeah, threaded through throughout.
So, yeah, the other thing, of course, is a lot of sound design. And, you know, working very intricately with Foley and effects and, you know, bedding that in around the music and making that really, I mean, Simon's an amazing sound designer. Marley, who did episode 3, I'm an all right sound designer. Yeah, but there's, you know, there's a lot of kind of minute work and going in deeper and deeper and deeper, you know, shaping it, getting little details in the background that really kind of make it feel like a real world, like something tangible. So, and it's fun. You have to stop yourself going in too deep, but, you know, putting in little details, like there's the protagonist's dad lives in a caravan. Or actually an old ambulance. He parks up beside the roads, and you can hear the cars going, you know, up and down outside the ambulance when he's sort of talking to people. But not just, you can hear the sort of muffled cars. You can also hear all his pots and his cups that are hanging from hooks around him, chinking and shaking as the cars go past. So it's putting those little details in can kind of make it the world seem kind of really alive. But actually, what I mean, one thing I've been thinking about a lot is the nature of podcast drama is kind of how we listen.
Yeah, where and how, yes.
Where, and I think it's a huge thing with podcasting. And I think you've got to look at what your audience is doing as they listen.
Yeah.
And blog culture is quite narrator-led. There's someone guiding you and holding your hand.
Yeah.
But you still have to imagine these different spaces inside the company, inside some labs, inside this old caravan. You'll get an action sequences, people having fights and running and punching and, so, you know, it's a very physical piece.
Yeah.
So I think it takes a certain amount of mental work. And it's interesting, a lot of the people who were big fans of it were listening to it when they were doing their jobs. They'd have jobs they could wear headphones when they were doing quite monotonous activities like running or something like that. It's not something you could listen to very easy in the car.
Mm.
There's too much detail and you get too distracted in the car. Uh-huh. It's very much kind of headphone listening from that point of view. It's not something you could listen to as you walk down the street in the city because you'd be too distracted. And I kind of noticed some of the other podcasts and a lot of the big ones actually are more simple in their use of sound and their framing. To go back to Black Tapes, it's very, you know, or Night Vale, or even Homecoming, all of them are very simple in their use of sound. There's a single voice mostly. There's someone perhaps even with a recorder. It doesn't matter where they are. I'm meeting this person in an office. I'm talking to you. I'm doing an interview with someone. It's a telephone call. You don't have to do a lot of mental work to fill in the gaps, which makes it easier to listen. Yeah. So I think that's one of the things with podcast drama to think about is how are people going to listen to your work?
Mm.
And what are you expecting of them?
Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps I might be thinking about trying something a little more stripped back next time round in terms of the listening experience. And, you know, just because it's a very immersive experience, but that's very demanding.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, the full immersion.
So creating those sort of soundscapes and things, did you do some live Foley yourself or was it all sort of pre-recorded things you found?
Oh, no, there's lots of live Foley.
Mm-hmm. Come on, give us some examples.
Oh,
your best top two.
having a fight with a leather overcoat in a alleyway at night was probably one of my favourite things. And just thinking if my neighbours...
Not your average Friday night fair in Brighton.
Yeah, well, actually it was fairly average in Brighton to do that. But me with my kind of like directional microphone with the fluffy and a pair of headphones on, and I'm simulating a fight, and I've got like various leather coats and various coats, and I'm punching them and throwing them around, throwing bags around. And it's sort of, there's this sort of like late night mist around me and a fox padded pot at one point. And even the fox looked like I was a bit disturbed. But that was kind of like, you know, a classic thing. And there's really hard, you know, there was metal slides that you kind of get like in art galleries and things, if you've ever seen them. And someone had to do a fight on a giant slide. I didn't get the slide. And there are some sound effects where, like in one episode, there's an old lift crashes down, it breaks and it falls. Mm. And I looked at that and I thought, oh God, who wrote that? Who put the lift crash in? And I thought, oh God, it was me, you prat. Well, it's me and David. And then I kind of like, I've got about a terabyte of sound effects and I kind of put lift crash in, hopefully, and there it was. And all I had to do was put sweeteners and augment it. There was a broken lift crash sound effect and it saved me about an afternoon's
Amazing.
Work.
Amazing.
So occasionally you luck out and on those really tough ones, but you know, you obviously edit and shape it. But on other ones, yeah, you're kind of, you know, constantly, it's all the little Foley effects. It's all the people moving medical instruments around on a tray. You know, that kind of small sound effect that you won't get on a collection anywhere.
Fine attention to detail. And have you added those Foley effects to anywhere, actually? Have you put them anywhere else for other people to use, or are they kept?
There are Foley effect libraries out there, and sometimes you can get them. But often when you're looking for something very specific, like, you know, someone moving needles around on a metal tray, you know, you just basically have to go and get a tray and do it yourself. And there was lots of frozen bags of blood in a cooler that someone's picking up and moving. You're not going to find that. I went to eventually got, I think I was using frozen prawns.
Lovely.
So yeah, just very specific sound effects. Are kind of what you find yourself doing, rather than sometimes the big ones you can luck out on. And then lots of nice, you know, you've also got to think about the atmospheres and how you're going to, you know, it's very often I look at collections and I go, oh, there's, you know, it's like roadside with nothing much going on is what I want. And you can never find it. There's always too much going on. So I'm often going out into sort of like suburbia and going, oh, look, there's a road with nothing happening. Brilliant. I'll record it because you want to put that in your background. Because sound effects libraries will have things happening. You're like, no, I just want nothing. It's
American cars. I want British cars.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yes. Yeah, you have to watch that. Oh, I tell you the other things. Waller. God, don't write crowd scenes unless you've got a crowd. Oh, God, that was hard work. The crowds in episode 5. I'm going to have no more crowds.
That's what I think we should do is an ADPP collection of Waller. We should do lots of different... We just go and meet in different places. Go a day. We'll go around, day trip. Everyone just go to the pub, to the park. and we'll put that online. That would be fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just have pretend to have various punch-ups and things. But again, Waller is so specific, you know. And my tip for Waller is go to acting schools.
Good tip.
Groups of young actors to... Well, they're normally young, but, you know, groups of actors just to go, okay, then you're an audience in an auditorium and someone comes on stage and says something outrageous, improvise, and they can do it because, you know, a lot of people can't do that and it's tougher than you think. So that's kind of, the next stage was that. And then you go into the endless mastering, which drives you mad, listening to the same thing over and over and wondering whether your ears are going to start bleeding, which I'm kind of blanking out now. What happened in mastering? And we did the post-show chats. They were fun. Cut those in next to it.
Yes.
And I think the big thing with that was just to, you know, from my point of view, was just not, it wasn't me hosting.
Okay, yeah.
And I went to one side and I tell you that. And then another thing to think about that as a podcaster is it helps having, you know, podcast is such a personal and intimate form.
Yeah.
You want the audience to associate with someone. You want someone there that can, oh, it's that person's show. And then they can get involved and they can feel it's a person, they know that person. So that's one of the reasons we did it.
Yeah, so pull them out of their character and hear them as they themselves. Yes.
Yeah, and whereas if you've just got a drama, it's kind of, oh, here's this thing, but it's not real and it's kind of no one's been talking to you directly. And a lot of the kind of, unless you have a fake host, unless you have someone pretending to be the host,
That's what I've been doing. Nobody knows. Shh, don't tell anyone.
But actually, the interesting one was when I kind of interviewed Casey Wayland about We're Alive, and he didn't have any direct hosting, but he did loads of work online, and he was really chatty to everyone online. So he kind of made up for those gaps. But in general, you kind of like, you need to give it, even if you're just at the beginning going, hi there, you know, blah, blah, blah. Here we are. Here's the show. Hope you enjoy it. gives it a frame and an identity. So that's kind of why we did that.
Because top tips for marketing, I mean, what knowing what you know now about everything you said about press already, but what would you say to someone who's got a show, they've done it, they've completed it, how to get it out there? What are the top things they should be doing, do you think?
First of all, the iTunes chart, we didn't get it. We lucked out in various ways. I know more now. The iTunes chart is based on new subscribers. So everything matters. It's entirely on new subscribers. And there's an algorithm, which I've been given a version of. So it's all about your impact in that first week, or that first day, that first hour. It's that impact. What happens at the beginning? So get everyone you know, mates, people you once met,
people in the street,
people you've slept with, people you've had rows with, people that used to be friends,
huge.
Family, actors' families, everyone to subscribe on the first day you go out. And if you can push that figure around, you know, if you can get everyone to do it at once, even if they don't follow, if you can get over 1,000 or so on the first day, and then you can kind of maintain some kind of pressure of new subscribers going, you can then catapult up the chart. So that's the first push. Okay. I did a massive push on that, and we got to number one. And then you kind of stay there, and then you get noticed. But and then you're just banging this drum. You know, on social media, we did a lot of direct marketing, contacting people on social media who followed podcasts. Come and listen to our podcast. Yes. Come and see the thing. And it was really interesting. As soon as I got tired, or Lizzie and I got tired and didn't push it so hard, it would start slipping out of the top 10. And then we'd go bang the drum again, and we'd go back up to number one. And this went on for about 3 weeks of just like, you know, furious kind of work. But we didn't get featured. We didn't get an iTunes feature. And I now know how to do that. I've been told, I've been given the email of the person at iTunes.
So, okay.
And that shows you how controlled it is. And also we didn't get mainstream press, which I've talked about already. And that makes a huge difference. Yes. So it was a very organic process.
With regards to next sort of steps from there, what you mentioned, there's something series two, but not necessarily following on from Blood Culture. Is that correct?
So yeah, so you wrap a project like that, and the only other thing I'd say is about marketing is don't give up, keep it going, push it. Don't be satisfied. Don't think, I had a good launch. Well, I mean, we marketed it for three months, and the nice thing is it's got enough traction that now, like, you know, we're getting a fair number of subscribers and new subscribers regularly. So it's kind of up there, and it hasn't gone huge, but it's got a good, it did well enough. Mm-hmm. Cool. I'd say that, you know, as a follow-on project, one thing we did with Blood Culture was we made sure it ended. It had a proper ending. It wasn't like, what's the mystery? It's like, no, we sorted the mystery, and everyone kind of, but then we had such a gas, you know, such a ball making it, and it was some of the characters we want to go back to. So, we're kind of going to write around new themes and new, we might be seeing some of the new, you know, some of the characters from that we'll take to a new story.
Exciting. Because, I was talking to someone the other day about how in audio drama as well, there's no kind of rep. There's no company, for example, that's doing something that's been successful and taking that and making something different with the same core team. I think, you know, like the successful television groups of the last 30 years, we've had a lot of that. But I don't know why that's not happening. And I think it should.
I think that there's a lot of people like, you know, these serials, long form serials. Mm. And also, you know, the economics of podcasting are pretty brutal. So I don't, you know, it is hard for people to keep a run of it. I mean, another reason why these shows, which are less production intense than Blood Culture, are successful is that they can keep banging them out. They can keep doing them. And I say that like not in a sort of like, oh, they don't, you know, they're not as good as mine. No, they are cutting their cloth to suit the, I don't know what the analogy is. They're doing it, you know, they're making work that is suitable for the form. So the Blood Culture was quite heavy going, and even, you know, in terms of the production, It's dense. It's it takes a lot of work. And there's, you know, we can't bang out as our episodes and build audience and build audience and build audience. So one of the things about looking forward to another season is also to think, okay, then it's going to be so long before we do another one. You know, it'll might be out end of next year. Let's not do it in such a way that the audience have to have heard season one. Let's do something completely new. And in terms of a story, and then people go, oh my goodness, there was, you know, we can find out how those characters got to be who they are by listening to season one, but it's not essential. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So that you it's almost season one would be like, feel like a prequel or something like that. And you go, oh, look, there's a different story with some of the same people. Well, that's kind of cool.
I love that thread.
And that means that people can encounter it anew and we can get new audiences and new kind of ways of doing things. And then people can have a bit of fun by looking back at season one and go, oh, my God, there they all are.
And so where can people find your work if for some reason they haven't yet come across one of my favourite podcasts of the year? Where would they be able to find it?
Blood Culture is at blood-culture.com, which I'm sure you'll put in the show notes that no one
will listen
to. No one looks at show notes, do they? See, that's the thing about, you know, the audience fall off. So, yeah, blood-culture or I've gone quiet on Twitter on Blood Cultural, which is at Blood Cultural. But that's only because I'm in the middle of doing funding bids and I have nothing to say at the moment. And you can, you know, metabeta.co.uk, you could go and apply for Meta. But yeah, you can find Blood Culture on iTunes.
And how about you and your future ambitions? So the book's coming out. What else can we, other than writing the next thing, expect from you?
I've been presenting on Radio 4. I'm moving out. I'm presenting a documentary on September the 20th. In the morning on Radio 4.
Very soon.
So 11:30 in the morning, I think, or 11
what
o'clock.
What is it about? About art, what?
Art in miniature. Tiny art.
Congratulations and exciting. Okay, so everyone must tune in.
Yeah, which is actually great fun. My goodness, that's actually out really soon, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm off to record the voiceover on Monday. It's very funny. I tell you, here's another thing as a writer. Standing in a studio, writing your own stuff, reading your own stuff and knowing it's going to be heard by a significant audience. Oh, you don't have to half learn about your writing that way. I've read my own stuff before. I've written for other people. But standing in that studio, I've already read some of the stuff and just thinking, oh, God, this sounded great on paper, but it's rubbish coming out my mouth. As a writer, make yourself read to other people. And read to a significant other people that you kind of go, okay, do I feel right?
Yeah. Dial a random number on your phone. Find someone, Skype a name you like, ring them.
ring up the one person you want to impress in the world.
Yes.
And then, can I read my script to you? And if you feel like an idiot saying it, go, oh, no, that's not right. I've got a kind of fun thing to point out to people might be that the precursor to Blood Culture was called the Flickr Man. Which used a lot of transmedia and was, I think it ran.
And that's still available
parts.
To find.
You can find that at theflickerman.com.
Amazing.
Or flickerman.com, which I got before Hunger Games. There you go, that's how old it was. Before Hunger Games came out as a movie, and everyone went, oh, there's this guy in Hunger Games called Caesar Flickr Man. I'm like, shut up. Right? So, that's kind of a fun audio drama that has kind of like got, you can spot kind of little commonalities between the two projects.
So, you should bring it back. You should do it, relaunch. This and the next thing.
I'm going to nick some of the ideas off it. plagiarise yourself. And other than that, I'm at lancedan.com, which is my own website.
You reside. Well, thank you so much for coming to speak to us for a second time. And yes, we very much look forward to the book and hope there's little star on page 99 with Audio Drama Production Podcast.
We should maybe when the book comes out, we should have another little chat.
Well, that sounds like fun. You can give us more secrets out then, because I know there's a lot of things you're not able to tell us until the publication. So yes, I think there's a lot of fun things to be learned from that. And yeah, so next year gives everyone time to save up, being the podcasters that we are.
And I haven't talked about the economics of podcasting. Get me on that. I could talk about that for
hours. My goodness. Yeah. So final question for you is podcasting something that people can make money from, in your opinion, independent podcasting?
That's an entire, I could go on about that for an hour.
Yeah, you've got 30 seconds.
You either go pre-funding like I did, or you go for live, something that would work as a live show, live event like Night Vale, or you do something that's exciting and fun and quick and easy like the Black Tapes Boys. So you kind of look at those three models.
Beautifully summarized.
Just do it for the fun of it, because the odds of getting rich are so low that you've got to be able to love what you're doing too.
You'll be rich in happiness rather than pennies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not that penny richness. That's rubbish.
Well, right, have Sarah. A wonderful, creative, exciting adventure for the next few months, and we would love to speak to you again. So, yes, enjoy, and thank you for joining us. Have fun.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.